Okay, good morning. I think rain may have kept a couple of people away. Does that mean that I'm audible without the mic?
Yep.
Are we okay? No, it's actually better for me if I'm not using the mic, because I'm using the mic, I'm distracted trying to think about how far to hold it, and I'm not a natural mic person. I don't know. Maybe, I don't know if there is a natural mic person, but it's not me. But just humble is great. I think that might be an art installation. Those chairs over there, like, don't move them. It looks like an art installation.
It looks like a crack now.
I have flyers here for a program I want to make sure to let you know about. Some of you have been at the day-long Tanakh seminars that my Beit Midrash does at the end of December. 2 years ago, we did Tanakh in a day, half an hour on each book from Tanakh, from Scripture. Then last year we did 10 heroes and 10 villains from Tanakh. So this year, it's on Wednesday, December 25th. Our title for the program is Tanakh Book of Failure? And what we're looking at are cases in Tanakh in which things did not work out. Or did not work out the way they were expected to work out. It's a little bit shorter than some of the other programs because the end of December is also Hanukkah this year and people need to get home to light the menorah. So it's going to start at 9 a.m. It's going to run until 4:30. Half-hour classes. It's entirely free of charge. It's in my Beit Midrash at Yeshivat Or Chaim. I'm going to give out some flyers so that people can see it. People take the flyers home, share them with people, whatever you like. If I remember later, I'll also include them when I send the follow-up email from today's class. There is a free dairy lunch during the program at 12:30, but you do need to sign up online for that. So I'm going to put out flyers here, and if I could ask people to just sort of pass them around so they get around, that would be great. And for anyone interested, there is, of course, an opportunity to dedicate classes. There's information on there about that.
And it's a nice way to celebrate Yom Kippur.
That wasn't part of the sales pitch. No, that wasn't. Okay. It's a nice way to celebrate Hanukkah.
I have nothing else to do. What else am I going to do?
Okay. So, good morning. Now we get started on the class. Please remember, if you have a phone with you, to silence your phone. That will be great. Thank you. Our first week we talked about the nature of the soul and the idea that the soul and the body have two different origins and two different experiences, and that from a Jewish perspective there really seems to be no reason to think that the soul would halt when the body halts. The second week we added two more points. Number one, we discussed the goal of human existence from a Jewish perspective, why there are human beings. Note, by the way, someone emailed me afterwards, and I wanted to make sure this is clear. We were not asking or answering the question of what does God get out of the existence of human beings? Why would God do that? That's a really good question in its own right. Our question was, what is the purpose of this human entity? What is it that God expects from us? And the idea of growth was what we emphasized. And then we talked about as well the third point, which was evidence within Tanakh for the existence of life after death. And that brings us to the discussion of what exactly does this life after death thing look like? Because even with the verses that we quoted, even with the biblical evidence that people survive their death, the Torah doesn't give you, Tanakh doesn't give you a whole lot of description of what that life after death looks like. There is some sense of a reunion of souls from a family, perhaps, that is gathered unto his nation. There is some sense of an awareness of what's going on in this world in some of the sources, and I want to come back to that, although that isn't going to be for this week. But there really isn't a whole lot of detail, and that's an understatement. So the question is, what does this look like? And you get to rabbinic text, and we'll be looking a lot at the Talmud today as part of this. You find a flowering of description. you find a place of reward, usually called Gan Eden, right, the Garden of Eden. You find a place of punishment called Gehinom, or Gehenna as it gets Yiddishized. We even have a concept of a limbo. What exactly is all of this, and where did it come from? I had a Rebbe, a teacher, when I was in, I think it was grade 7, who used to say to us, right, Fruchthandler, he used to say to us that the next world is actually just one big room. It's tables and tables and tables filled with Sfarim, with Torah texts, and everyone is sitting and studying, and there's no clock. So for the people who really like that, that is Gan Eden, and for the people who don't, that's Gehenna. That was his. It's a very economical view, you know, of what that's like, and you can imagine the impact of that on a seventh grade kid.
My God.
No, but really, this is a problem, right? With all of the evidence that we've brought to support the idea that there is a life after death, what exactly does that look like? We already saw a little bit of it when we saw the passage from the Talmud in Shabbat that talked about six questions that one is asked after death. That already indicates that there's some kind of a judgment, right? Not indicates, it says that there is some kind of a judgment going on. Where does the rabbinic idea of judgment, of reward, of punishment after death come from? Nope. We had it before them, like all their ideas. Marilyn asked if that was a Christian idea. But the general rule with Christian ideas is that they generally have their roots, you know, in Jewish ideas, even if they've taken them in different directions. So I believe there are two main sources within Judaism for the idea that there is judgment and there is reward or punishment after somebody passes on. Number one is in biblical hints. So for example, we saw Abigail's blessing/curse that she gave to King David, where she said that his soul should be bound up with life and that the souls of his enemies should be cast in a catapult, referring to something that's supposed to happen to the soul, which is not pleasant for the enemy, but is pleasant for David. Or we saw the verse in Daniel, in which he talked about an ultimate judgment for souls. He was talking about a time of Tchiyat HaMeitim, of the resurrection of the dead. But he suggests that there is some kind of a judgment in which the righteous will be rewarded, and those who have sinned are going to be punished for it. But there may be even clearer expression of this in biblical text based in source number one. This is from a work by Professor Richard Steiner, Disembodied Souls, the Nefesh in Israel and Kindred Spirits in the Ancient Near East, with an appendix on the Katumwa inscription. I brought the full title because I thought Katumwa was a good word. I don't actually know what that is, but it's an inscription. But he talks about this idea of reward and punishment after death, and he says, another common Pentateuchal expression, right, expression from the Bible, that may belong here in this discussion, is v'nichrata ha'nefesh ha'hi me'ameha. I referred to this in last week as well. The idea that, as he writes here, that the nefesh, that Hebrew word is nefesh, shall be cut off from its kinsmen. We've already said that nefesh is some aspect of life of the soul. So there's a verse that says for people who perform certain transgressions that they will suffer this being cut off from their kinsmen. And in the 13th century, Ramban Nachmanides argued in his commentary to Leviticus that expressions of this type imply the nefesh survives death. And he quotes Nachmanides. You should know and understand that the forms of excision is the English word for what it called in Hebrew karet, to be cut off. The forms of excision mentioned with reference to the nefesh, are a great source for trust in the existence of the nefesh after death, and the granting of reward in the world of neshamot, of the souls. For when he, blessed be he, says that nefesh shall be cut off from the midst of its kin, or that nefesh shall be cut off from before me, it teaches that the nefesh that sins is the one that shall be cut off through its sin, but the other nefashot, which have not sinned, will exist before him in the splendor on high. So Maimonides, who he's quoting here, says the very fact that you say some people will be punished by being cut off suggests that everybody else is not cut off. That's straightforward. But then he continues, and he says, Ramban's discussion, Nachmanides' discussion, which is rooted in ancient rabbinic exegesis, has been largely ignored by modern scholars. That this neglect is unjustified has been shown by Jacob Milgram, where he writes, the other possible meaning of karet, yeah, you have to just deal with the funny notes on top of the letters. But karet, excision, is that the punishment is indeed executed upon the sinner, but only after his death. He is not permitted to rejoin his ancestors in the afterlife. This meaning for karet is supported by the idiom that is its antonym. Meaning we have another biblical expression, bless you, which is the opposite of karet, which we've talked about. Ne'esaf el, to be gathered to one's kin or to one's fathers. Particularly in regard to the patriarchs, the language of the Bible presumes three stages concerning their death. They die, they are gathered to their kin, and they are buried. Right? That's the order of things as expressed biblically. They die, they are gathered to their kin, and they are buried. All of which is evidence for a belief in the afterlife that permeated the ancient world and the concomitant fear that a wrathful deity might deprive man of this boon. In other words, what's being proposed here by Milgram and accepted by Professor Steiner is that the opposite of karet is to be gathered unto one's ancestors, which we talked about. And he's noting something fascinating. Someone sent me an email 2 weeks ago. I'm not sure at this point who it was, but it was someone who was traveling in Italy. Was it Marcia?
It was Israel.
Yes, and it was in Israel. I was in Israel, not in Italy. Okay, about a tour in which they had been informed about the ossuaries. The practice was in Roman times, maybe before that too, but I know about it from Roman times, that a body would be buried, they would wait for the flesh to decay, and then the bones would be taken and put together in a box with other bones from the family. And the suggestion has been made that, and I don't remember if the docent said that on your tour, but I think
it was actually First Temple times that this was wrong.
Okay, so they're talking First Temple. So but the idea was suggested that the phrase "be gathered unto their ancestors" is a reference to the bones being put back together and not an afterlife reference. So the problem with that idea is that when you read the biblical text, and this is what Milgram emphasizes here, the order, it doesn't fit that. Because the order in the biblical text is they die, they are gathered to their kin, and then they are buried. It's not talking about a burial and then eventually having the bones put together. This is something that is spiritual, that in fact is before the burial even takes place. It's when the soul leaves the body. So that's why I, that's my response to the docent. But in terms of the idea here that Steiner is suggesting, that Milgram is suggesting, the point that I want to make is that this provides a basis for the idea that more is going on after one passes away than simply you've now moved somewhere else. Because you're talking about a penalty of being cut off, or you're talking about something that evidently is considered a positive to rejoin your family. The week of American Thanksgiving, you know, we can have a debate about whether it is enjoyable to rejoin your family. But the idea here seems to be that it's more than simply a continued existence. Something else is happening. And I think that's your first of two reasons why the rabbis will look at biblical texts and look specifically for evidence of reward and punishment after death, and not only a continued existence. That's number one. Number two is the Torah's internal logic. And for this, I bring you source number two. This is a classic. You may have heard this discussed in some context. It's about a particular event The event at first in the Talmud is considered theoretical, but then they say that somebody actually witnessed it. Let me explain it actually outside the text. There are certain mitzvot for which the Torah says, if you perform these, you earn long life. Right? Honest weights and measures is an example of something that is supposed to earn a long life. What other mitzvot earn a long life? Anyone know? Nope. Honoring parents. And another one is chasing away the mother bird before taking the young. Okay, so those, the Torah says, you earn long life. You earn long life for doing them. Why you're chasing away the mother bird is a good discussion for another time. Is this meant to be humane? Is this stuff, you know, specifically inhumane? That's a good discussion for another time. But the point here is that the Talmud posits the following scenario. There's a young man who's walking with his father, and they see a bird's nest up in a tree. Father says, you know, I'd really like the eggs. And so the young man climbs the tree, honoring his father, chases away the mother bird, fulfilling the second one, and then falls and dies. And now what do you do with this biblical promise of long life? So take a look at source number two. They taught in the yeshiva of Rabbi Yaakov. If one's father told him to climb a building and bring back young birds, and he ascended, sent away the mother, and took the young, and then upon his return he fell and died, then what of his length of days? Where would be the good that is due to him? What do you do? Like how is that promise fulfilled? So the Talmud's initial approach is to say, because the term in Hebrew for long life is leman yarichun yamecha, or some grammatic version of it, it appears in a couple of places. So that your yamim, your days, shall be aroch. The word aroch in standard Hebrew means long. Long, lengthy, correct. However, the word aroch in Aramaic, which is a sister language of Hebrew, well, a child language of Hebrew, really, the word aroch also means of high quality. Arich is a term that's often used for something that is good, something that's of good quality. So he says, that's not actually his answer, that's an answer that others give, but he says here, so that your days will be aroch in the world that is entirely aroch, in the eternal world. In other words, it's talking about the next world. Do these mitzvot, your days will be good in the next world, so that it will be good for you in the world that is entirely good. That's the Talmud's first answer. So to which the Talmud then says, wait a minute, why are we even entertaining this possibility that somebody could die when they're doing these two mitzvot? How could that be? Perhaps that story couldn't happen. To which I say, no, Rabbi Yaakov saw that happen. And whether he literally saw that happen, or just said, you know, we live in a world in which people do good things and they suffer anyway. Either way, he says, we've seen enough of that sort of thing happening. To which the Talmud says, well, maybe that only happens if the person who was climbing up the building was thinking of sinning. And therefore, he was punished because he was actually thinking of sinning while he did that. To which I say, that's not the way it works. God does not view thoughts as actions. Then there's a whole discussion, which I skipped, about what about idolatry. Doesn't relate to our discussion here. Rather, the Talmud's conclusion. Rather, the reward for mitzvot is not in this world. Or as it's said in the Aramaic, schar mitzvah b'hai alma leka. The reward for mitzvot are not in this world, they are in the next world. And then the Talmud goes through this regarding a particular sage named, he's identified here as Acher Elisha ben Avuya as well. He also came to question reward and punishment, and the Talmud's answer is that reward isn't in this world, reward is in the next world. In other words, what we're saying here is, aside from biblical texts that indicate reward or punishment after this world, there's also the Torah's internal logic. The Torah's internal logic is that God does not simply give commands and say, I want you to do this, but that there's a promise of reward if you do it right. And there's a promise of punishment if you do it wrong. And if that isn't playing out in our world, and let's be real, this isn't playing out in our world, it must be, it's what's afterwards. It's a logical point rather than a scriptural point. First idea is that it's scriptural, the second idea is that it's simply logic. Both of these factors are what lead the rabbis to look at biblical verses and interpret them in ways that indicate that there is judgment and punishment and reward coming after death. So what we're going to do, in a moment I'm just going to take some questions, but after that what we're going to do is see what they saw as what this place of reward looks like. What did they see as the way this place of punishment looks like? And how did they find that within the biblical verses? What was the basis for those descriptions? Yes?
Maybe you answered this already. So, are we thinking that the judgment that happens, that's final judgment?
Yeah, no, you're asking a good question, and we haven't addressed it yet. The question was, is that judgment that happens then the final judgment? So there's a passage in the Talmud in Rosh Hashanah, which is usually quoted Rosh Hashanah time, and there are two different ways you can take it. It's a description that you may have heard at some point or another about how on the day of judgment, meaning Rosh Hashanah, Yom Hadin, Sifrei Chayim v'Sifrei Meitim, are open in front of God. Sifrei Chayim and Sifrei Meitim. There are two different ways the commentators take that phrase. Some commentators take that as the book of life and the book of death. In other words, God has two books, two ledgers open, and he decides which way people are going to go. Exactly, as expressed in Unetana Tokef, mi yichyeh u mi yamut, who will live and who will die. However, there's another view within the commentators, and I think it's the dominant view, that says, it's the literal translation, Sifrei Chayim means book of the living, and Sifrei Meitim is books of the dead, and the idea then is that judgment occurs on an annual basis. In other words, Rosh Hashanah is not only the day of judgment for the living, but it is also a revisiting for those who have passed away. And lest one say, wait, hang on, you're going to like this part. Lest one say, what's the point? They left this world already. They haven't done anything since then. The answer is, their deeds in this world have repercussions. Things have played out since last Rosh Hashanah. Their descendants, the people they taught, the people who they said hello to, whatever it is, were impacted by them. And those deeds, hopefully positive ones, will now redound to their benefit. So in that sense, it's actually an annual judgment. I would add to that an additional idea, which I don't claim to be fully explaining now, but I do want to come back in a future week to this, which is the idea that on a yard site, there is some kind of elevation going on for the soul. What that means is a really good question, but I want to get to that in a later week. That's not for this week. But that also can figure into this calculation. Yes? Can you read? So, Nurit asks the question of how the Torah accounts for bad things happening to good people. As I said to Marlene last week, that's really a question that's beyond the scope of what we're doing here. In other words, we're within the context of life after death. But what I will say is that life after death, what I'm presenting here as the second of the two logics behind reward and punishment after death, is dealing with that problem. In other words, one way in which they look at the problem of, but bad things happen to good people or good things happen for bad people in this world is, yeah, and there's a balancing out that's going to happen, it's just not here. It's not in this world, it's in the next. That's not the only answer to the problem, but that is one of the answers that is offered. Barbara and then Ricky.
In some traditions, when you visit a Shiva house, you say to the people who are sitting Shiva, I wish you long life. Is that something to do with this?
That's a good question. That's the South Africans, right? And in England? Okay, I just knew about it from South Africans. Yes, there is a practice in a Shiva house of wishing a mourner long life. I wouldn't necessarily view it as being from this, but it's an interesting idea. In other words, the biblical verse talks about having long life, right? I always assumed it was just, you know, because someone just passed away, and so we're wishing them, you know, wishing these people they should have long life. But it's an interesting idea. I don't know.
Is it performing a mitzvah by honoring the dead? Maybe they are performing a mitzvah.
No, how? By, how does that honor the dead?
Well, when they're sitting shivering,
yeah.
They've done the funeral, they've done all the right things. Maybe
yeah.
Good
mark for you for
your
life. Oh, I see. Okay. I hear it. I don't know. I want to think about this. It's an interesting idea. Ricky.
We haven't touched on Gidgul Neshamot yet, but if that is what to talk about, then which Neshama we...
So Ricky, you are correct. We have not discussed it yet. It is in an upcoming class. It's on my agenda, not to worry. Sarah. Sarah. Yes. Yep. It works both ways. It works both ways. Sarah asks, I said that the good deeds that one influences, right? If you influence somebody in a positive way and get them to do something good, then that works to your benefit even, you know, after this world. And yes, the opposite is also true. The opposite is very much true. Yeah. Yeah. And people do.
Yeah.
No, it's a standard thing that people say. In general, I'm not going to challenge something that is a standard custom that people do. There's a reason for them doing it. I saw a hand here, and I see hands there. I'm going to take a couple more, and then we're going to move on. Yeah. That's very nice. The idea that wishing long life is you should be able to do many mitzvot in honor of the person who passed away. It's a fine idea. It's a good wish. I'll endorse that. Sandy, and then Judith. And then Sandy and Judith, and then we're going to go further. Yeah. Sorry?
I don't like to be conflicted, but I have a problem with numbers.
Okay. So Sandy wants us to read this, read source number two from a vegetarian perspective. And like, you know, you're taking, not literally vegetarian, but wait a minute, the father's asking the kid to go take away the young birds. This is a fine question, but beyond the scope of where we're going in this topic. So I'll just say briefly that there is a lot of literature in Judaism, number one, on the issue of in general, eating animals. We know that, I think we even mentioned in week one, originally human beings were meant to be vegetarian, and that there's a concession involved in having human beings eat meat after the flood. Number two, the idea of taking young in particular is a loaded issue within Judaism. We have the story, which we've discussed on other occasions, of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the codifier of the Mishnah, being criticized for when they were taking calf out for slaughter, and the calf is you know, bleeding, complaining. He says, "Go, that's what you were made for," and he's criticized for it. So such sympathies do exist. I'm not sure that I'll read it into this story in particular, although I wonder if you couldn't read it that way, that the father inappropriately sent the son to do it. I don't know. It's a little bit of a reach, I think, because it's something worthy of another discussion, but not for right now. That's what I would say. Judith.
It's just a two-part question. It appears to me that the writings are very interested in looking after the soul as much as looking after life here. That almost as much importance is given to the well-being of the soul.
What do you mean by the well-being of the soul?
Well, performing the mitzvot, not doing wrong, because it would be harming the soul in this afterlife in some way.
Where do you see that?
Well, the judgment of open punishment, you know, so that it would be troublesome.
Right, but there was no mention here of how much weight we're giving to the impact of one's deeds here versus the impact of one's deeds in the afterlife. They haven't actually said that.
I guess not. It just seems to be hinted that, you know, it has to be taken care of. It's almost like life itself.
See, I would have argued the opposite, that this text actually goes the other direction. What Judith is suggesting is that we're giving more weight to the impact on the soul of good deeds or bad deeds than we are to the impact on this world of the good and bad deeds.
It's very important. If your deeds here, if they're bad, for example, will be troublesome for you in the afterlife, so to speak, your soul.
Yeah, but it's not saying that, it's not downgrading the impact that it makes in this world. It's simply saying there's another dimension to it. Lisa, what were you... You see something there?
He's talking to you.
Yeah, sorry.
Sheldon.
Okay, I apologize.
So what does reward for mitzvot is not in this world mean if it isn't what that lady was asking for?
It's
telling you not to focus so much on...
It's telling you that the reward isn't coming here. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't focus here.
She didn't say not to focus. She's saying wait on the next world.
Right. What makes the right? But what I'm asking is the impact. Saying that your reward or frankly punishment is coming in the next world, I don't think that de-emphasizes the importance of the impact of what you do here.
So they might be equal.
Or equal, one greater, one lesser. I just don't think that that's dictated by the statement that reward is coming in the next world. That's where I'm stuck. It may be a human nature. Once you tell me that I'm going to get paid in the next world, then that may become more of a motivation for me than do good things here. And that's one of the things that we talked about when we asked the question of why is it that the Torah does not present this strong emphasis on the next world in its descriptions of where we're rewarded and punished. One of the points that we made was the concern that it would lead people to de-emphasize what goes on here. But I don't think that's required by the text. I think that's human nature.
Bad things happen to good people. Your reward for being good is in the next world.
Possibly.
What happens here.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to really go further at this point because we have a lot to talk about. Okay, so there is this idea of a judgment, which could be an annual judgment, not just a one-shot judgment. We talked about the judgment a little bit with the six questions. And then we get to a description of the place of reward. Now, again, the biblical text does not provide any clear descriptions of what's going on there, but the rabbis see hints within biblical verses and biblical ideals. So, two different versions of what happens. Number one, a physical place. Heaven is something physical. The other, that it's an experience of communing with God. Take a look, please, at source number 3, which is based on a verse in Ecclesiastes. The verse says, one goes to the home of his world. Ecclesiastes chapter 12 is a description of death. It's a poetic description of death. It describes the way that a person's body deteriorates, meaning in old age. And then it says, one goes to the home of his world. So Rabbi Yitzchak explained, that means each righteous person receives a dwelling befitting his honor. Right? However good you were, you get the home, Beit Olamo is the term. You get a bayit, a home, that suits whoever you were. Each person has their own house. That's the idea. Hopefully it's a ranch, you have to climb steps. But that's the suggestion. I'm going to go a little further with it first. And so you get another verse in a different another line, not a verse, in a different passage in the Talmud as part of a bigger discussion. It's just kind of thrown in there that one of the sages actually visits the Garden of Eden. And that's a story in its own right. But in number 4, he went and he encountered Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, one of the great leaders of the period of the Mishnah, sitting on 13 golden thrones. I don't actually know whether golden thrones are comfortable and whether you really need 13. 13 is often in the Talmud meant as a large number. It's often used as a really large number. The Tosfot that makes that comment. So don't get hung up on that per se. But the idea here is that he's living in luxury, and it sounds like physical luxury. That's what it seems to be saying. On the other hand, take a look at source number 5, which states, based on that blessing that Abigail gave, the souls of the righteous are stored under the divine throne. God's got a throne, so to speak. Obviously, God, not being physical in Judaism, doesn't actually need to sit down anywhere. Not on one throne, not on 13 thrones, not made of gold or anything else. But the idea is, this is, so to speak, the place where God is most manifest. That's where he's found. And the souls of the righteous are right there. Because the soul of my master shall be bound in the bond of life. It means to be close to God. But not only to be close to God, but actually to communicate with God. And here we get the idea that my Rebbe from grade 7, Rabbi Fruchthandler, was proposing. And it's what we call Yeshiva Shel Mala. Yeshiva, an academy for study of upstairs. And the idea that there is a place of Torah study going on up in the heavens. So take a look at source number 6 as one example of this, based on a verse in Jeremiah. Rabbi Yonatan said, anyone who teaches his peer's child Torah, if you teach someone else's kid Torah, you will merit to sit in the yeshiva above. Because the verse in Yirmiyahu and Jeremiah says, if you will return, meaning if you will return to God, I will bring you back. Before me, you shall stand. Lefanai ta'amod. You will stand before God in the next world. Now, if I didn't have a belief in the next world, I would just say, before me, you shall stand in this world. But what they are doing is channeling the fact that I have biblical verses about a next world, and I have a belief in a next world. This is talking next world. Another passage to this effect in source number 7. Ruth, I haven't forgotten you. Anyone who gives a scholar merchandise for business use will merit to sit in the yeshiva above. If you help him get engaged in business, get him a start, then you'll merit to sit in the yeshiva above as well, because of another verse from Ecclesiastes. For in the shade of wisdom is also found the shade of money. That's actually considered a positive here. What exactly that verse, how that verse leads to that passage in the Talmud is a really good question. But one more line about this yeshiva above, in number 8, from Midrash. Anyone who takes pleasure in Shabbat will merit to sit in the yeshiva above. Why? Because I have a verse in Yeshaya, in Isaiah. It's actually the Haftarah read traditionally on Yom Kippur morning, which says, then you will take pleasure in God. It says, if you observe Shabbat, if you enjoy Shabbat, it isn't just observe, if you enjoy Shabbat, then you will take pleasure in God. When is that? In the next world. And that is described as happening in this yeshiva upstairs. Ruth.
This is Bruno Shaw's approach. He thinks that heaven will be study and hell will be having a good time.
Well, Bernard Shaw is a satirist, and you have to know that going in. I happen to really enjoy Man and Superman, but I don't share the rest of his vision. Diane.
Don't we have some prepared one that says something to you that will be
All true, and that is actually a really important source. Diane points out, we have a Mishnah towards the beginning of Pirkei Avot, which teaches, don't be like servants who serve their master for the sake of reward, be like servants who serve their master not for the sake of reward. But here's the thing, there was a classic misunderstanding in Jewish history, because you could read that sentence in two ways. Either be like a servant who serves the master, shelo al menat lekabel pras, meaning not for the sake of reward. You're doing it because God said to do it, and it's a good thing to do, and therefore we do it, not because we have an eye on what we're getting. Or the other way to read it was al menat shelo lekabel pras, that you should do it on condition that you not get reward, that you should not anticipate any reward at all, and in fact it should be I'm doing it without anticipating reward, and that's not the mainstream read. It's okay that there is reward. It just shouldn't be your goal in doing it. And here I would throw in another Talmudic line, which says, do mitzvot even shelo lishma, even if it's not for altruistic purposes. In the end, you'll come to do it for the right reasons. But a person shouldn't say, I'm not going to do it because my intentions are not pristine. Do it without the pristine intentions. Don't worry about it. The pristine intentions will come. Yes?
So is there anyone that defines that if you're a bad person, your soul is exactly the same as you? Or is your soul better than you? Or
right.
Is
so.
Sorry.
So this goes back to something we had said in the first week when we were talking about the soul, and there's a debate. Most sources seem to indicate the soul is considered pure. It may be influenced into driving the body in a wrong direction, but the soul is inherently pure. And then there's the other view that the soul can actually be contaminated as well, that it can actually become corrupt through wrongdoing. We're going to come back to that in not so long from now because we don't have that much time left. So hold the question. We're going to we'll see more. Ricky, I saw your hand, but I'm going to go a little further right now. We're going to go further right now. The idea that there is a yeshiva upstairs, that there's study going on. And in fact, the Talmud elsewhere brings like debates that are going on up in the heavens. It's explained really interestingly by a friend of mine, Professor Chaim Saiman, in source number 9. He has a book which came out last year called Halakha, the Rabbinic Idea of Law. Some of you may have heard him. He spoke at Shari Shemayim about this book. And he talks about this idea of a yeshiva upstairs, an academy upstairs. And he says, what we have seen here is surely not the only view of heaven in the Talmud. But it is a view of heaven that only the Talmud could fathom. This idea that heaven is study. And in a few short lines, the Talmud has told us quite a bit about how it understands both heaven and halakha, Jewish law. First, note how the natural state of halakha is an argument about rules that have meaning regardless of whether they are used to decide a case. I should give you a background on this. I didn't. The piece that he's describing is a passage in which it describes how there's a debate going on in the heavens regarding laws of nigaim. Nigaim is a form of skin ailment, usually mistranslated as leprosy. And if a certain mark appears on your skin, then it is impure. If the mark appears this way, then it is pure. And then there's a debate going on in the heavens about a particular circumstance with a mark that appears on somebody's skin. That's the debate that they're having up in the heavens. So he says, we can only presume there are no mortals and certainly no lepers in heaven. Right? This wasn't a practical conversation that they were having upstairs about whether to render somebody pure or impure. And even if there were, God certainly knows whether the blotch or the hair came first and what the rules are going to be in that case. But the legal rule reflects something important beyond its applicability to a given case or controversy. That is why God and the angels debate these incredibly specific details. In other words, the description of a debate going on in the heavens about a particular case in which a mark develops on somebody and there was a hair first or there wasn't a hair first, that whole discussion, he says, is trying to give us insight into the way they view the importance of law in the abstract, and that it has significance even when it has no application. But then he says, the second point follows. Law is something intrinsically worthy of study. So worthy and important that it is the central activity that takes place in heaven. To the Talmud, ultimate perfection is God and the angels arguing over the intricacies of halakha. The intricacies of law. So that's what feeds this idea. In other words, the core idea is the souls of the righteous end up being with God. A spiritual heaven. Well, then what are they doing? Well, it's got to be halakha, because that's what you would do. That's perfection. But that's how they arrive at this idea. And in number 10, I brought you Maimonides, 1,000 years later, where he talks about this idea that the soul goes to God. And he says it's logical. When the physical entity formed from the elements disintegrates, and the neshama is lost, since the soul is lost, it's not found outside the body, it needs the body for all of its actions, the nefesh still is not lost. Nefesh, neshama, aspects of the soul. And he goes on to say, that goes to God and it lasts forever, etc. So what we have are two different presentations of heaven. A physical one, you get a house, and it suits whoever you were in this world. And a spiritual one, you go to be with God, and you may learn a lot about Jewish law, which would have been useful while you were here. But nonetheless, those are your two schools. We could reconcile those views if we wanted to. We could say, well, maybe the physical one is just an allegory, or we could say you get a house, but you know, you have a house, but you need something to do. You're not going to hang out at the house all day. So you have a house, and then you go study, and then you go home to the house in the evening. If we really wanted to, we could figure that out, including the question of, but what good is a house if it's just a soul? Like, what are you doing? But I want to first move forward with this idea and then come back to that question, because I want to talk about what the place of punishment looks like. Again, we've said you don't get meaningful descriptions in the biblical text. You have this idea of the catapult, which we still have to come back to. But what is this all about? So, first of all, the name that is used, that people use colloquially to refer to hell in Judaism is, as we said, Gehinnom. Gehinnom, Gehenim, comes from, it's a contraction of Ge Ben Hinnom. Some of you may have actually been there. Right? How many of you have been there? Okay, so we have some people who have been there. I wasn't making a joke. It's a valley. It's in Jerusalem. And they can take you on a tour. You pay somebody, they'll take you on a tour of Gehenna. If you take a look at source number 11 and source number 12, we find references to this Valley of Hinnom, or Ge Ben Hinnom. It was a place of idolatry, and specifically the Molech idolatry we've mentioned before, where they passed their children into or through fire. That's the place that the sages looked at and said, that's hell. A place where that would be going on gives its name for hell. And again, in the rabbi's writings, you find two different visions based on biblical verses. And I'm going through this part a little bit quickly, just because I want to make sure to get to a resolution and not just leave us with questions about physical and spiritual. I want to make sure to get through this part in one piece. So we find visions of a physical place, like on earth. If you take a look at source number 13, Rabbi Yirmiah, son of Elazar, said, Gehinnom has three entrances, in the wilderness, in the sea, and in Jerusalem. In the wilderness, because, and they and all they had descended alive in Sheol. That's in the story of Korah, in the book of Numbers. They described as descending to Sheol, into the depths. So he says, yeah, and they went straight from there into Gehinnom. In the sea, because Jonah cries out. He said, I cried out from the belly of Sheol, and you heard my voice. We read about that in September. In Jerusalem, as it is written, the word of God who has light in Zion and an oven in Jerusalem. Okay, the oven being a reference, God's oven being Gehinnom. And it was taught in the yeshiva of Rabbi Ishmael, the light is Gehinnom, and the oven is the entrance to Gehinnom. So Zion, Jerusalem, has an entrance to Gehinnom. Now, you could say all of this is allegory, and not taking it as a physical place. But take a look at source number 14. After Shabbat ends, every week, we perform Havdalah. In Havdalah, we have wine, grape juice, some beverage. We use spices that smell nice, meant to make you feel a little bit better about the end of Shabbat with its pleasure and going into the week. But there's also a blessing on a flame. Why are we doing a blessing on a flame at Havdalah? What's that about? So two different approaches. One approach, and this I think is what Barbara is talking about, is the idea that during Shabbat I was not able to manipulate fire. I wasn't allowed to light anything. Now I am able to do so. And so therefore I light a flame. That's one explanation. A second explanation, though, is that God actually created and gave human beings fire for the first time Saturday night. Remember, we were created on Friday, and it was a really busy Friday, right? There was a lot going on. We had to eat the fruit, get kicked out of the garden. Like, there was a lot that had to happen. Traveling on a Friday is never good, so we didn't get fire at that point. We got fire for the first time Saturday night. Then how did Eve light candles? I don't know, I guess she flipped the switch and used the electricity. I don't know. But take a look at source number 14. Our fire was created on the first Saturday night. However, the fire of Gehinnom was created on the first Friday. The fire of Gehenna, it sounds like it's a real fire, like a substantive one, was created on the first Friday. Not because Fridays are Gehenna, that's not what he's trying to say, especially short Fridays, but what he's trying to say, perhaps, is because that's when the first sin took place. So that's when it has to get fired up, so to speak. You can give other explanations. But it seems to be a physical place. And then on the other hand, we have other approaches. So that in source number 15, the Talmud talks about this karet that we mentioned, and it's simply the soul being cut off in the next world. It doesn't get to experience the next world. And then flip on to number 16. We quoted part of this before. The souls of the righteous are stored under the divine throne, as it is written, the soul of my master shall be bound in the bond of life, and the souls of the wicked are imprisoned, and one malach, one angel, stands at one end of the universe, and the other at the other end, and they catapult these souls from one to the other, as it is written, the souls of your enemies will be catapulted in the spoon of the catapult. Again, that blessing from Abigail, from Abigail, suggests that it's just about the souls being in some kind of limbo, which I still want to come back to next week. So, you have again a physical description and a spiritual description. Yes?
Just the way that's written, I might have missed something before.
Yeah.
It sounds like there's a line. This is where you're righteous and now you're wicked. Like, to me, it's a continuum. So, where
good.
Is the continuum?
Right. So, I will tell you to take a fast look at the opening line of number 19. We aren't ready for 19 yet, but just see the opening line. There are three groups on the day of judgment: perfectly righteous, perfectly wicked, and everybody else, the intermediates. Yes. Yes, and you read, and then we're going to go further. Yeah. So, I don't think so. Nurit asks, is this why we have this idea of limbo? Is that why we have the concept of a shomer, where the body is not supposed to be left alone between death and burial, somebody remains with them? As I understood that, it goes to something I want to talk about next week, which is the idea that the soul is aware of what's going on in this world, and therefore we don't want to leave them alone. We'll talk about that more, God willing, next week. But here's the thing. We have these two visions of this place of reward. We have these two visions of this place of punishment. One physical and one spiritual. I get that all of this is based on biblical verses. And I get that the biblical text indicates some element of reward or punishment in that world, and that's what we're basing it on. And the logic of, well, there's got to be somewhere where accounts get settled, that's got to be the next world. That we get. But why physical and spiritual? So take a look at a key source, number 17. A conversation between Antoninus, who's supposed to have been a Roman emperor, and Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the canonizer of the Mishnah. The story of their relationship is a great story for another time. Antoninus said to Rabbi, the body and soul could exempt themselves from judgment. How? The body could say, the soul sinned, for since the day the soul left me, I've been lying silently like a rock in my grave. I didn't do anything wrong. I can't sin on my own. It's the soul that did it. And the soul could say, the body sinned. Since the day I left it, I've been flying in the air like a bird. I don't do anything wrong on my own. It's the body's fault. Each one can blame the other. And Rebbe responded, I will compare this to a human being who had a beautiful orchard in which there were beautiful new fruits. He put two guards into the orchard, one lame and one blind. This is your hint that this is a parable, okay? Because this is not what you do. The lame one said to the blind one, I see beautiful new fruits in the orchard. Come put me on your shoulders. We'll bring the fruits and we will eat them. And of course, that's exactly what they did. So the one who can't walk is on the shoulders of the one who can't see, directs the one who can't see, and goes over to the trees, gets the fruit, and they enjoy them together. After some days, the owner of the orchard returned. He said, where are the beautiful new fruits? The lame man replied, don't look at me, do I have legs to walk to them? The blind man replied, do I have eyes to see? So what did the owner do? He put the lame man on the blind man, and he punished them as one. He figured out what they did, and he says, all right, you get zapped together. So God brings the soul and puts it into the body, and he judges them together. As it is written, he will call to the heavens above and to the earth for the judgment of his nation. He will call to the heavens above, refers to the soul, and to the earth for the judgment of his nation, refers to the body. The body and the soul are meant to work together. If they work together, then the reward is provided for both. Now, the body is in the grave, right? How is the body going to experience anything? So, apparently what happens is some kind of physical pleasure that is analogous to the physical pleasures that were not prioritized while the person was alive. In other words, while you were alive, you learned to put the ethical first. To say, I am not pursuing pleasure, right? We talked about this in week two. I said that the goal is to put ethics ahead of pleasure in this world. So all the pleasure that the person said, I'm going to put this on the back burner for now, that is in some level restored to that person in the next world. In some way, even though there's no body at that point, that's what the Talmud is describing. So you have this nice world with these nice houses, and whatever it is, however that works, there is some level of pleasure that's given to them, as well as spiritual satisfaction worthy of the level that the soul achieved. And if the body and soul don't work together, then the punishment is provided for both. Again, not for the body literally, the body's in the grave, but providing a punishment which parallels the physical pleasures that the person prioritized. This person put pleasure first in this world. Now they have to answer for it in some way in the next. And that's that fire image. Providing spiritual punishment, paralleling the damage that one did, whether that's to the soul or with the soul, depends on how you understand what the soul is and how it's impacted. But that's what will happen for the person in the next world. So I want to sum up what we've said. You'll see on the bottom, I've started doing something new for some of the classes. Review questions. They're not graded. If you want to write out answers and send them to me to make sure that you got what we were saying, that's fine. If you want, you're not getting a number grade. But the idea of judgment and of posthumous reward and punishment originates, again, to a certain extent in biblical texts like that about karet, as an example, and in the logic of the Torah as well, which indicates there should be reward and punishment somewhere. The places of reward and punishment are described by the rabbis based on biblical verses in physical terms and in spiritual terms. And the lesson of the parable of the blind and lame guards is it's because the body and soul worked together in this world, and therefore there has to be some element of a physical suffering as well as some element of a spiritual one. There's more that I wanted to say here. I'm just going to throw in a couple of points very quickly, and then we'll resume next week. I'm not going to get through everything, so some of it will have to hold over. But first of all, it's a question that I always get asked. Are non-Jews present in the next world? Absolutely yes. It's implied in a Mishnah in Sanhedrin, which talks about whether Bilam, the non-Jewish prophet who cursed the Jews, gets into the next world or not. The very fact you're having that conversation says that in general they do. And I brought you a story from the Talmud of number 18, you can read it later, which involves a Roman officer who makes it into the next world for saving Rabbi Gamliel. He makes it into a place of reward. But the idea seems to be that, yes, they are in the next world. That's number one. Number two, this is in source 19. It goes back to the question of the annual judgment or permanent judgment. Is a passage in the Talmud in Rosh Hashanah which suggests that Gehinom is not a permanent existence. It's not, you were good, you're in Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden. Not so good, Gehinom. And that's it. That's where they remain. That's not the way that the Talmud describes it, but rather, there is a judgment, and then after that judgment, they will have to go to Gehinom for some period of time in order to answer for what they've done, to be punished for that which they did. And then after that, they get to go to Gan Eden. They get to go to the Garden of Eden. And that's why I brought you source number 19 for that discussion, the intermediate descent to Gehinom and float and ascend. They actually end up leaving Gehinom. And then the last bit, so we will get through it, is number 20, I brought you references to certain passages from the Talmud, not the passages themselves, which speak about a get-out-of-jail-free card. There are certain traits which one can have, develop, which will either mitigate or eliminate the Gehenna experience. So, certain traits, humility, reverence for God, fear of sin, but also deeds. So, tzedakah, looking after the sick, taking care and reciting Shema. The Talmud in these passages that I reference here talks about how each of these can be essentially a get-out-of-jail-free card. So, worth knowing about. There's much more to be said, obviously, but hopefully this gives us some understanding. And then next week, God willing, we get into some fun things. Limbo, dibbuks, reincarnation, whether the dead are aware of this world, that'll be for next week, God willing. Thank you very much.